This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, we'll hear about the newly formed Family Independence Initiative Cincinnati. But first, this Thursday is the 30th anniversary of an event that marked the first contemporary global financial crisis. The 1987 market crash saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average decline by 23% in just one day. The huge percentage drop remains the largest one-day stock market decline in history. Markets around the world also declined that day. And joining us to talk about what's known as Black Monday are Dr. Richard Silla, financial historian and chairman of the Museum of American Finance in New York City, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. And you can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we've been having a bit of trouble reaching Dr. Silla, and we're trying to get back to him on a different line here at this point, Chris.
Okay.
So let's start off by talking about what the heck happened on October 19th, and why in the world does anybody want to remember that particular anniversary?
Well, I think we want to remember it for the same reason that John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist, wrote about it in the Atlantic Monthly. He wrote a book called The Crash of 1929 back in the 1950s, and then he updated it several times, and now it's, in fact, the issue that I bought was from 1988. But in 1987, he began to warn people about the parallels between what was happening in the market in the late 80s, the mid-80s. 1986 had been a fairly decent year, and then 1987 had been kind of a go-go year. There was this new mania coming that was grabbing a lot of attention on Wall Street. And if you remember the old days of junk bonds and leveraged buyouts, the firm of Drexel Burnham Lambert.
This was the heyday, wasn't it?
This was the absolute rock and roll time. The whole greed is good, all that stuff. Leveraged buyouts were the rage of the day. There had been tax reform. So this was towards the last half of the Reagan 8-year presidency. The markets had been in a bull market since 1982, August of 82. There had been a good deal of wealth created. And now at that time, there were people who were just marveling at the easy returns. And what Galbraith wrote about was the 1929 parallel. And in it, he talked about the common threads between 1929 and 1987, and there are many. And so today, this very week, the cover story of Barron's talks about almost the same exact thing. You know, are there parallels? What are the parallels between today's market, which this morning, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 23,000?
We certainly have had a big run-up.
It's been a heck of a run going back actually to March 9th of 2009. This is a bull market that began from the depths of despair in 2009 after the crash and Great Recession, and has now just, you know, people have been standing there in disbelief that you could have bought things at a dollar that are now trading nearly $30 a share. So there's this sense that, well, maybe this can't go on. But then if you look at valuations and you say, well, geez, stocks are cheap compared to this, that, they're expensive. Some are cheap, some are expensive. So these are all the same things that were happening 30 years ago.
So some people are seeing echoes, in other words, of what happened 30
echoes,
years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's the concern that there might be a, you know, this could happen again, that is keeping some assets cheap.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Silla.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, we've got you. That sounds better.
Much better.
Hopefully it'll stay that way for us. Thank you so much for joining us today, by the way. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah. Describe what happened on October the 19th. What happened to the Dow Jones Industrial Average that day?
Well, it was the biggest one-day decline in the history of our stock markets. Basically, you know, in rough numbers, the Dow was at about 2,200, you know, less than one-tenth of what it is now. It was at 2,200 the previous Friday, and it ended up on Monday, October 19th, at 1,700. So it fell something like 22 or 23% in one day, outdoing the crash of 1929, which took 2 days, October 28th and October 29th, 1929, to fall the equivalent amount, about 21-22%.
Yeah.
So October 19th, 1987 was the one biggest crash in U.S. history. Yeah.
Dr. Stella, this is Chris DeSimio.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. What blame, I guess, can we assign to the underlying causes versus the delivery system? In other words, what was going on that was so dangerous under the surface in the economy? And we were kind of hinting about leveraged buyouts and so forth. But then the delivery system, namely program trading and portfolio insurance, just brought destruction and devastation much faster. What's your take on the underlying causes and the vehicles which brought all this financial destruction?
Well, I think there was the year 1987 is a bit like the year 2017. I'm not sure if people realize that, but what I remember, since I'm old enough to remember this, that in early 1987, the stock market started hitting benchmarks, like 1800, 1900, 2000, 2100, 2200, all the way up to 2700. And that reminds me a little bit of this year. I think you just mentioned that the Dow hit 23,000. Well, I think it started the year somewhere in the 18,000, so we hit 19,000, 20,000, 21,000, 22,000, and just today, 23,000. That happened in 1987, so people were very optimistic, and I noted at the time that it only took about 2 or 3 weeks to get up another 100 points. Well, lately it seems like it takes a few weeks to get up another 1,000 points. So there are certain similarities to 1987 and this year, and I think what it says is that investors were very optimistic and thinking that everything was just fine, we're mourning in America again, President Reagan, and I think this year we're saying, the market is very calm, and we're just marching uphill, and so there are a lot of similarities.
Yeah, back then, of course, we had the beginning of portfolio insurance and program trading, and portfolio insurance, if memory serves me correctly, involved selling things as they were going down. And the most convenient or efficient way for some people to do that was to sell futures contracts in Chicago that represented baskets of stocks.
So in layman's terms, it was hedging your bets.
Right, or kind of arbitrage. You would sell something, and then in New York, where the actual stocks traded, the problem was that they were running under a different set of rules. So in New York, if you wanted to short a stock, in other words, sell a stock that you didn't own, buy a stock that, or sell a stock at one price, hope that it goes down so you can buy it back and capture that movement, well, you had to wait for an uptick before you could do that in New York. So if you wanted to short a stock, you couldn't short it until someone else had paid a little more for it, until the last trade had been higher than the previous trade. In Chicago, that rule didn't apply. So you had the futures just going, dropping, plummeting, I guess is the word that comes to mind. And in New York, they were handcuffed. And it was that disparity, I think, that caused a lot of the dislocations. Dr. Silla, does that...
That reminds me of what happened that day. We didn't realize it on the day itself, but it didn't take very long afterwards to realize that financial futures, which were sort of an innovation of the 1970s and 1980s, so you could actually have these futures contracts on the stock market. And what happened on that day was that the Chicago futures markets were falling faster than adjusting faster than New York because of that uptick rule you mentioned, where you couldn't short a stock until it went up a little bit. So what happened was that New York was a cash market, and the futures got out of whack with the cash market in New York. And what happened on that day is that everyone said, well, I can make money now by selling stocks in New York and sort of buying the futures, which were lower. And that just led to this tremendous selling pressure in New York on that day, which is why you got this big down move, exacerbated by portfolio insurance, which, as you mentioned, had the curious characteristic that the way to protect yourself in a down market is to sell.
Right.
And that's what happened that day. All kinds of people following portfolio insurance sold stocks, and that made the market crash.
You always hear about portfolio insurance and program trading getting the blame for what happened on October 19th, 1987. But it almost sounds like there are a lot of different factors that went into this whole thing, Chris.
There were. It was such a strange time. There was a headline event that had nothing to do with stocks and the financial markets that had grabbed the country's attention, and yet it was an apt metaphor for what we were about to experience. You might want to Google this name, Jessica McClure. Does that name sound familiar? She was a little 18-month-old kitty who fell down an 8-inch well and was trapped there for 58 hours. And the whole country was captivated by this little kid trapped 22 feet below the ground. And would we get her out? So this was just, you know, the whole financial markets were about to go down a similar hole. No one knew if they were going to get out either. So you had that going on. Then you had, as Dr. Sella said, you had this portfolio insurance and program trading heading on. Interest rates had been rising too. So as by the time we got into September and October, the yield on the 30-year Treasury was trading at the time, but interest rates had been steadily hiking higher all year round. I think they were pushing about 9 or 10% back in 1987. So there was competition for stocks. And the other condition, the financial media was just beginning to become more democratized, for lack of a better term. The internet didn't exist then, but at least for most people, it wasn't in your home. No one had the World Wide Web, or very few people had access to real-time prices. But there was a new network on cable TV called the Financial News Network, FNN.
FNN. Mm-hmm.
Right. And they had their own index, the Fancy, they called it. And they had some of the people who were still on CNBC to this very day. They had, I think, Sue Herrera was there. Art Cashin, who was the head of floor trading for Payne Webber, was a frequent guest. Bill Griffith, who still hosts The Closing Bell, was on the Financial News Network at the time. And so this was all brand new. And we all woke up that morning. Remember, the Friday before had seen the first 100-point move ever in the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Nowadays, you'd say 100 points, no big deal. But back then, was a huge deal.
Right. And it's in their own perverse way, people were waiting to see it happen, almost like, well, okay, it's a, you know, it was, became clear that the market might move 100 points. It had never happened before. The Dow hadn't. It fell, I think, of 108 points that Friday. So people were going into the weekend kind of nervous to begin with. And then that Monday, with all these conditions, you know, a market that had still been up for the year, interest rates rising, portfolio insurance and program trading starting to kind of be in play, we got, I think the trade deficit figure came out and it was worse than expected. There were some rumblings about Germany, you know, messing around with the currencies. We're going to go to a currency war with Germany. That's all it took, though, was for that one piece of news. And then the trade started hitting the tape. And in fact, Art Cashin, who's still on CNBC, is the director of floor trading for UBS, is quoted in the Black Monday book by Tim Metz, who was a writer for the Wall Street Journal and others. His quote, and he said this, he said it on TV, he resorted to Latin, morituri te salutamus, the gladiators entering the arena saying, we who are about to die salute you. And this is how this is kind of the attitude that was going on. It was a very bloody, financially bloody affair that day.
Yeah. We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Thursday marks 30 years since the 1987 stock market crash that saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average drop by nearly 23%. Our guests this afternoon are Dr. Richard Sella, financial historian and chairman of the Museum of American Finance in New York City, and Chris DeSimio, who's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. If you'd like to join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris and Dr. Sella, I remember after that 1987 crash, there was such a fear that it would resemble, the aftermath would resemble the what happened after the 1929 crash, which was the Great Recession came on. But in the case of 1987, it didn't. And I'm just wondering, why, what prevented that in 1987? What was different?
Well, I think that, this is Dick Silla here, I think that it was probably a wrong interpretation of the Great Depression of the 1930s that it was the result of the stock market crash, but countless generations of Americans were taught that the stock market crashed in 1929, and then we had a Great Depression from 1930 to 1933. I'm a professional financial historian, and I decided even before the crash of 87 that the problem of the Great Depression of the 1930s wasn't so much the stock market crash of 1929. Many people forget that the stock market rallied after the crash of 29 and was back up by April of 1930, about where it was before the crash of 1929, I mean right before the crash. Not to its all-time high, but it got back up to the level of where it was in October before the crash. And so the connection of the stock market crash to the Great Depression is rather tenuous, but everyone was taught that the stock market crash was a cause of the Great Depression. So in 1987, the stock market crashed, and all these people who had been taught about the crash of 29 and the Great Depression said, oh, we're going to have another Great Depression. I was one of the people who said that wouldn't happen, and I turned out to be right. And I was sort of glad as a financial historian because it proved my point that whenever you have a stock market crash, you don't necessarily have a Great Depression. Actually, the economy continued expanding in 1988 and 1989. And there was a very mild recession that began in 1990, but the stock market crash of 87 didn't really harm the economy that much at all.
And thank you for correcting me, because I think I slipped and said there was a fear it would trigger another Great Recession, but it was Great Depression. So I didn't quite have my terminology right there.
More recently, we had the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's... I remember going to work then the following morning with my Wall Street Journal, back when I got it in print form, and just looking at the chart and thinking, well, this chart, this precipitous drop, this cliff at the right-hand side of this chart will be a mark that will live forever. And now, 30 years later, when you look at long-term charts of the market, You don't even have to step very far back from the chart. That little blip just kind of disappears, especially if you're looking at one of those logarithmic charts. It disappears because within a year or two, maybe I think it was 2 years, the Dow was, you know, it was again setting new highs. And as Dr. Silla said, it wasn't until 1990 that we had the junk bond market collapse, and then we had the war with Kuwait, in Kuwait, not with Kuwait, but when Iraq invaded Kuwait and sent oil prices higher. And that led to some market choppiness, but it didn't, you know, the crash itself.
Yeah, the Persian Gulf War, too, as it was called back at that
right.
time. Yeah.
Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. But the crash itself did not cause the depression. But I think what a lot of people are concerned about now, and what Dr. Silla is involved with, which is interesting and I think helpful, is the Museum of American Finance. In other words, one central place where all this history is kept. And if you're in New York City, you can visit it, as Sheila and I did a couple weeks ago. It's a magnificent museum with a really slick bookstore, too, where I got this nice Alexander Hamilton tie and this one of Dr. Silla's books. It's extremely well done. It talks about the history of American finance going back to colonial days and bringing you up into the future, into the present. And it's very well done. And if you cannot get to New York, and interestingly, this museum is not far from where the original buttonwood tree is, where in 1792 the so-called Buttonwood Agreement that established the New York Stock Exchange took place. But they have a wonderful online presence as well. And you have links to the Museum of American Finance and Dr. Silla's books at the WVXU.org website.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. Susan sent us an email. She says she turned 27 on Black Monday, so she remembers it very well. What a way to celebrate your birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday, sort of.
Yeah. Dr. Silla, how many points would the Dow have to lose today to match the percentage drop that we saw on Black Monday 1987?
Well, everything is about 10 times greater, so a 100-point drop then would be 1,000 points now, so we lost 500 points, roughly speaking, on October 19, 1987. So that would be a 5,000-point drop today. We're at around 23,000, so let's suppose that we had a crash tomorrow. We'd go from 23,000 down to about 18,000, and it would be similar to the 1987 experience.
That would get people's attention.
I think so.
Yeah, it most definitely would. Let's talk to Rob. Hi, Rob.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
And go right ahead.
You know, it's interesting listening to the story. I actually was fortunate enough to have worked at a bank that day and then the following day in this wonderful new technology we developed called automated teller machine. And I do remember there wasn't bank management. Obviously, they had the experience of being able to look at history and determine, you know, there could be a run on the bank based on the activity in the market. But we all of a sudden realized we've got these machines open 24 hours a day. If there's panic, it won't end when the branch opens. And I remember that evening having to sit and actually watch cash volume in the ATMs to make sure that we weren't experiencing a run on the bank and we didn't know it because, you know, we couldn't close the bank down anymore because we were literally open 24 hours a day.
Interesting. So what happened? Did some of the ATM machines run out of cash or did things kind of go smoothly?
No, they pretty much went smoothly. And I think it kind of mirrors what both gentlemen have been saying, that there were enough modifications to the overall financial system that we didn't have the panic that, you know, we'd had back in the 20s. But it was a legitimate fear amongst folks who were responsible for managing the bank. It was a subsidiary of a Society Bank at the time.
Yeah, interesting.
But I remember that being a real issue that night, and we didn't have cell phones, so it was, hey, you're just going to have to call in, and we're going to have to use pagers to communicate to figure out if we needed to start shutting things down.
Yeah, that's certainly maybe something you remember
for
a long time.
Oh, it's pagers.
Thanks, Rob. We appreciate the call.
It beat semaphore or flags or signal fires. Dr. Sella, tell us today what, you know, when our earlier caller talked about fear, and we've all seen what fear can do. We've had two so-called flash crashes in the last 10 years or so. We had one back in May of 2010 when, you know, people are still trying to figure out exactly what happened when the Dow fell about 1,000 points in a matter of an hour, hour and a half. And then about 2 years ago in August, we had another situation where the market opened about 1,000 points lower. Is the technology sometimes too far ahead of people's ability to handle it emotionally?
Well, I think that's what happened in 1987. By the way, your caller just now talked about it not being so bad. People didn't rush and pull all their money out of the ATMs. The big difference between the 1930s and the 1980s was, as a result of the Great Depression, we brought in deposit insurance. So everybody's bank account was insured by the FDIC, and therefore they didn't panic so much. In the 1930s, people did panic and rush to their banks and pull money out, not so much because of the stock market crash, but just because banks began to fail in the fall and winter of 1930. So that's a big difference. But I think, yes, the technologies are different, and they're new, and that's what we saw in 87. We had futures markets. What's new today? Well, we have high frequency trading, and I think that had something to do with that flash crash we had in recent years. But in the background, we also have more and more people indexing their investments. And I think we're talking about the market seems very stable and it marches uphill steadily. What I think is going on is more and more money is flowing into index funds, including new ones, and they just have to go out to match the index. They have to go out and buy the stocks that are there now, and some of those are selling at high prices, but they keep having to buy them to create a new index fund or expand the ones we have. And that's kind of a new technology. It's not so dramatic, but I wonder what's going to happen when the markets start going the other way and people take their money out of the index funds. Maybe we'll have maybe not a crash, but maybe a set decline as people pull money out.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. There's been, Dr. Sella, a lot of concern expressed in the financial media about not only regular index funds, but exchange-traded funds in some in general, depending on how they're constructed, the so-called market cap-weighted funds.
They trade like stocks.
Well, they trade,
ETFs,
right. They're index,
trade like a stock.
Right, they're index funds which trade on the exchange. But then there are leveraged funds. And when you when you introduce the word leverage into anything, you are magnifying the risk, because whether you borrow the money yourself or the fund is borrowing the money to then amplify the bet, which is what a lot of these leveraged index funds are.
And they usually are amplified by two or three times.
Sometimes two, sometimes three times. Exactly. Yeah. And leverage always introduces an element of risk that doesn't exist without it.
A little more volatility, perhaps?
A lot more volatility. And the part of the problem is, and this is what we ran into in 2 years ago, and even in 2010 with these flash crashes, that these index exchange-traded index funds frequently don't trade as gracefully as the underlying assets. So if you've put in a stop-loss order, for example, as a way to hedge your bet, you better make sure that you have what's called a limit order on that too, so that it won't – that stop-loss order becomes a market order when your whatever price you put in is hit. And if it doesn't trade, if it crosses through that so-called strike price and then doesn't trade for another $3 or $4 below, you just sold it.
You just
at that
lost
price.
Some more money,
right.
Basically.
That's right.
In layman's terms.
Right. But yeah. If you have a limit order, then it would only sell at a price that you specify. So you have to understand exactly what risks you're taking. And I think this is what's great about a lot of the work that Dr. Silla has done throughout his career. And is, you can read about it, the Museum of American Finance, that when investors don't understand the risks that they're taking, when panic happens or when emotions get the better of you, then it always makes it worse.
Chris, what's in place today? They have technologies they put in place to try to safeguard against this to some extent on the markets, but what is there right now?
I think Dr. Silla, I hope, would agree with me. Common sense and having a plan are really your best safeguards. And keep your eyes open and your ears attuned, because when things start to look and sound easier and better than you, that deep in your heart you know they should be, you know, stop, take a breath, call your financial advisor, or do your homework, do something, because it, you know, there is a reversion to the mean that is like Newton's law of gravity.
And just don't panic, right?
Never panic.
Never panic. Dr. Silla, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We really appreciate it. And Chris,
my
thank
pleasure.
You for joining us too.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Silla.
Dr. Richard Silla, who's a financial historian, and he's chairman of the Museum of American Finance in New York City. Also, Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. Listeners are reminded the information provided on the show is general in nature and may not apply to your personal investment situation. Coming up, we'll learn about the mission of the Family Independence Initiative, Cincinnati, and its strategy to reduce poverty. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.